Today, our first reading that we heard is one of the most famous parables of Jesus. In fact, it actually preaches itself, but that has not stopped preachers for centuries from elaborating upon it, as I will today. So, it's commonly called the parable of the Good Samaritan, and it's found only once in the Gospel according to Luke. It is beautifully crafted and a moving illustration. It also stands as one of those examples where the teaching of Jesus pushes people and pushes us as well beyond a mere affirmation of belief, but to real actions. So as we hear the story, it is precipitated by a question posed by, in the translation it says, lawyer. We are not to construe that with our version of lawyer. You're off the hook, Kimberly Brown. But an expert in religious law is who is speaking. And it's meant to be issued as a challenge to Jesus. But in quintessential Jesus style, he subverts the question and creates a challenge for the questioner as well. So the lawyer asks, what is necessary for eternal life? Jesus asks the expert to tell him what, as the expert, he reads in the law. And the lawyer offers the expected response, an already accepted synopsis, the twofold commandment, the synopsis of the law and the prophets, to love God with your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and to love your neighbor as yourself. So far, so good. Good job, lawyer. Yeah. But then it takes a turn on the curious question, who is my neighbor? We're told that this ancient lawyer was seeking to justify himself, but let's be honest. It's not just that ancient lawyer who was looking for a loophole. We all look for loopholes in the law of love, don't we? We all look for loopholes in the law of love. Of course, Jesus, love, of course. But does that actually really include that person over there who I find scary? Or that person over there who hurt me so terribly badly? Or that person over there who comes from the wrong side of the tracks, or the person I simply can't understand, or the person who doesn't believe as I believe or speak as I speak. Love my neighbor, sure, but who is my neighbor? We ask it all the time in our hearts, whether we ask it aloud or not, all the while hoping for a loophole, looking for some fine print that gets us off the hook. And then we hear this famous story. A man fell among robbers who beat him and left him for dead. Both a priest and a Levite, very religious persons of the day, who could provide, in fact, the same pious answers as the lawyer provided, walked down the road but crossed to the other side. Perhaps they were fearful of becoming ritually unclean to come in contact with a dead body. That was a religious rule that provided them with a welcome loophole. Then comes a Samaritan. Jews and Samaritans had a common Jewish ancestry, but they held one another in hostility and contempt for centuries, for all kinds of reasons, economic, ethnic, but not the least of which was that each considered the other to have gotten their ancestral religion wrong. But in this story, it's the Samaritan who actually gets it right. Which is Jesus' point, isn't it? And even though that ancient lawyer couldn't say the words that the Samaritan was the better neighbor, it was a point that was not lost on him. Who is my neighbor? Who is your neighbor? One of the favorite places I have ever lived in my life was the apartment that I lived in Los Angeles for the final eight years out of the 19 years that I lived there. It was in the Los Feliz neighborhood, and if you know LA, it wasn't in the fancy part of Los Feliz, trust me. It was in the part of Los Feliz that is just up from Hollywood Boulevard, which is not terribly glamorous in the area in which I lived. But it was a wonderful 12-apartment complex, two-story apartments, six apartments around a small courtyard. And during the years that I lived there in those 12 apartments, 10 out of the 12 were always occupied by single or coupled gay men. So it was a very comfortable small neighborhood that we were able to share. I knew all of my neighbors by name, even the ones that sometimes meddled in my business more than I wanted, and probably I in theirs. But it was a terrific, comfortable, and felt like a very safe, neighborly place to live. It was also located in the most diverse neighborhood in which I have ever lived in my life. Within a two-block radius of where I lived, there was signage in five different languages and four different alphabets. Five languages, four different alphabets within a two-block radius of where I lived. It was a great place. And one night, when a fire broke out at the corner of our building, it was also especially good to have known my neighbors well. As flames erupted in a bush and started to lick their way up the outside wall on the opposite apartment building, all of us came out to quench the flames and to comfort one another. Thankfully, no one was hurt, but knowing one another made that evening far easier than it would have otherwise. It is said that the best way to be prepared for a disaster or a crisis is to know your neighbors. Think for a moment, how many of your neighbors do you actually know? More than at glance, but by name. That is no doubt true, because when you are thrust into a crisis, you may not be able to contact distant loved ones or to get to the store for supplies, but you can run across the hall or across the street, and it's probably better if that's not the first time that you've met your neighbors. But the downside of this is, not only do most of us not know our neighbors, for many of us, most of our neighbors are very much like us. Probably of similar economic status, maybe even of the same race or culture. Our neighborhoods too often become comfortable ghettos. You know, whenever I hear on the news, which we've heard even recently here in Portland, hear someone say, quote, "We just didn't believe something like this could happen in our neighborhood. We didn't believe something like this could happen in our neighborhood." It makes me wonder if they think the people in the neighborhoods where they do believe something like that can happen are not their neighbors. Can't happen in my neighborhood. It happens in other neighborhoods. They must not be my neighbors. Who is my neighbor? As the parable of Jesus reveals, a neighbor is not just someone who lives near us. It's someone who can feel with us. It's not a place that you find on a map. It is a place that is found in your heart. As a community, we have undergone a period of considerable stress when we deliberated about our decision around this building, and we face upcoming considerable stresses as well. The recent separation from our church administrator, today's congregational meeting, a case in point, beginning this process of what will happen with our building and where might we next locate at some point in the future. And in times of stress, As I mentioned last week, we don't always act or speak our best, do we? So that's why last week and this week, as we face stresses and challenges together, I'm hoping to remind us of some simple but important things that we already know. Last week, it was the reminder of that most fundamental universal ethic and standard that we have. Religions, which differ greatly and profoundly in theological and philosophical realms, do in fact largely converge in the realm of ethical behavior. They differ in what to believe, but they agree on how we are to act. With dozens of parallels across religions, the golden rule guides our behaviors. In all things, do to others as you would have them do to you. In all things, do to others as you would have them do to you. And today, a reminder of that rule, which is not unique, but a little more particular to Jewish and Christian tradition. And I see it's really a different angle on the same universal rule to love our neighbors as ourselves. Love our neighbors as ourselves. It was already an ancient guiding principle of Jewish religion and practice. It's first found, here's a quiz for the real Bible geeks. Where is it first found in the Bible? Anybody? 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 Leviticus. Love your neighbor as yourself. Unexpected, isn't it? You expect something else out of Leviticus, don't you? Love your neighbor as yourself. Leviticus 19:18. By the time of Jesus, it was already held and embraced as one of the two greatest commands. So as we navigate stressful time together, I want to suggest, I think, three practices in applying both of these rules. To do unto others as we would have them do unto us, to love our neighbors as ourselves. Practices because we need to practice getting it right over and over and over again. We practice what we want to get good at. Do we want to get good at doing unto others as we would have them do unto us? Do we want to get good at loving our neighbors as ourselves? So, a few practices to apply to our words, our actions, our attitudes. And I've mentioned a couple of these even recently, but not in a sermon. So here's the sermonized version. First practice, that is the practice of humility. The practice of humility, because all of us are human, therefore our knowledge is partial and imperfect. None of us knows everything about a person, a situation, and probably not even ourselves, if we're honest. None of us knows everything. But all too often, don't we speak and act as if we do? So, I have recently observed a curious habit that I developed. And it, yeah. It's confession time, So I noticed a couple of years ago, I can't remember exactly when it was, but I was walking down the street, it may have been with one of my family members or a couple of friends, and I was saying something about just going this way or doing that thing, and I realized I had no idea what I was talking about. But I said it really confidently. I said it exactly like I knew exactly what I was doing. And I will find that I have this like random tidbit of knowledge that I think I might know about something. And I say it with like great authority. And I'm disturbed to realize that. I consider it a danger of the profession. A danger of the profession because you have to stand up in front of people and say things with conviction. Now, I pray that I never say anything I don't believe from this pulpit, but I practice saying things with conviction, and sometimes I end up saying things with conviction that I don't know to be true, but it sounds like I know them to be true. Dangerous. Any pastors that, oh, yes, 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 thank you, Reverend Deborah. Yes, it happens, doesn't it? None of us knows everything, but all too often, we act and think and speak as if we do. Humility, humility. Second, the practice of grace. It is a central tenet of our religion. We are flawed human beings, and we will all sometimes fail. I will fail, you will fail, everyone will sometimes fail because we are flawed. And because we fail, our faith says we receive the grace of God that allows us chances over and over again. We need the grace of one another. If we know ourselves to be in need of grace for our shortcomings and our failures, will we actually extend the same grace to others that we wish extended to us? The practice of grace. I've heard Mona say, we're going to grace you through that. It sounds like grace is a verb and not a noun. Humility, grace, and the third, maybe for me, sometimes, in some seasons, the hardest of all. The third practice, to believe the best rather than the worst of someone, of one another. Don't we want others to believe the best of us, even with our failings, even with our flaws and our faults? Don't we want others to believe the best of us? Why then do we often believe or talk about others as if it was the worst and not the best of them? Maybe it sounds naive, but isn't that what we're called to do? I actually think that's why the story of the Good Samaritan would have been so unsettling for the lawyer and the others in that original audience. The enmity between Jews and Samaritans was so intense that to suggest that the other possessed admirable, even superior character was a shock, but it was an important shock. Accustomed to believing the worst, Jesus told a story that reminded them the very best was within the unexpected other. It can be a difficult practice, particularly if one has experienced the pain of betrayal by others. But what is the other choice? To become jaded, to become cold, to become hard-hearted? Will we choose to believe the best or the worst of another? Who is my neighbor? It is an ancient and a powerful question. And this week, I saw something new in it. Others, I imagine, certainly have over time, but it's the first that I saw this. And I think unknowingly, the lawyer asked the question with the answer already within it, even without the story. Unknowingly, I believe the lawyer answered the question within the question that was asked. Who is my neighbor? Who is my neighbor? Do we know who our neighbor is, or do we only know what our neighbor is? Do we know who our neighbor is, or only what our neighbor is? Our neighbor is white. Our neighbor is black, gay, straight, Christian, Muslim, poor, rich. How many thousands of labels of whats do we have to place on other people and ourselves? We are more accustomed to viewing others as objects and not as subjects. a neighbor. Sorry. There you go. A neighbor is a who and not a what. A neighbor is a who and not a what. My neighbor in my favorite apartment in Los Feliz was a middle-aged African-American gay man with HIV. That's what he was. Who he was Greg. Who he was Greg. The what may have accurately described some things about him, but who he was Greg, and he was a great neighbor. What is the description of a thing? Who is a relationship with a person? Who is your neighbor? Not just the other side of the street, but on the other side of the ocean, or even on the other side of the aisle from you at church. Who is my neighbor? The one in whom I see a fully shared humanity. Do I see it enough to exercise humility and grace and to believe the best of them? If yes, I have found my neighbor.